We the People.
We the People.
We the People of the United States.
We the People of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
In the summer of 1787, 55 men would gather in Philadelphia. They were tasked with fixing the government of the United States of America. Over the course of 4 months, they would debate, argue, refine and prepare the first document of its kind in the history of mankind, an attempt to prove that men can rule themselves by law. Over the next 3 years, the 13 United States would debate the ratification. This is the story of those men and of those times. It is a look at the ideas, the concepts, the debates, and the history of the Constitution of the United States. This is Constitution Thursday.
As the delegates return from their vacation, so does the summer heat return to Philadelphia. Sitting down to work, they begin to read and digest the draft that Rutledge has put together while they were gone. There are many points of contention, but also many points of agreement. One agreement is that they are moving too slowly, and that the nation is growing impatient. James Madison feels that the work could take many more months. Washington knows that they do not have that much time. The first solution offered is to work longer days, from 10 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, with no changes to the schedule now allowed. With the new plan in place, they take up the qualification for electors. Should property ownership be considered? And, really, 4 o'clock? Oh, come on.
If you've ever taken a look at the founding of the various colonies that would eventually make up the 13 United States of America, you'll find some very interesting stories. Many of you are, of course, familiar with Virginia and its tobacco and Jamestown, and you're familiar with the Puritans in Massachusetts, perhaps maybe not so much with the Puritan rejects in Rhode Island or the Anabaptists of Georgia. One colony, however, stands out for its founding and kind of a unique way given the realities of the world when it was founded in the 1630s. Maryland is unusual in that it was founded as a Catholic majority colony. It was founded for the purposes by Lord Baltimore of giving Catholics a place to go to avoid the persecution that they were getting in England and particularly Ireland, where Lord Baltimore was actually from. The state of Maryland, as we know it today, the colony of Maryland, was a Catholic haven, which is interesting to me because, again, my family, the colony was founded, by the way, in the 1630s. The charter was issued in 1632, but they didn't actually land there until 1634. When they landed there, they essentially bought a pre-settled Indian village from the local Indians there. They had a guy with them that spoke Seneca quite well, and they negotiated the sale of the village, and the Indian chief moved the tribes out, and the first colony in Maryland was actually purchased, kind of pre-built, by the settlers. The colony intrigues me because, again, founded in 1632, settled in 1634, my family, my Holt side of my family, my maternal family, came to America in 1647, and they came to Maryland, which, again, if you consider the happenings in the world that day, is indicative of perhaps their religious faith at that time very possibly was Catholic. That's why that's where you would go if you were. If you weren't, you went somewhere else. Now, there were some other advantages to going to Maryland. One was it didn't matter if you came as a free man or an indentured servant. Maryland gave you 50 acres of land regardless. So it's possible that they went there even being Protestant. But it seems likely that if you were Catholic particularly, you would go there. The interreligious stresses were so much during that time period that it seems unlikely you would go there without adhering at least or not minding the primary religion. And given that my parents, my great-great-great-great-grandparents were English, it seems unlikely that they would have gone there without being Catholic, which of course raises all kinds of questions and considerations for my history. None of them bad, by the way, don't get me wrong. The Marylanders were quite, I don't know what the word for it is, they were quite determined to be successful. And throughout their history, they had a long reputation of being somewhat disagreeable with their neighbors. At one point, they actually fought a war with Pennsylvania. Believe it or not, they got into a shooting war with Pennsylvania called Cresap's War in the 1730s over a boundary and some law enforcement issues. But generally speaking, Maryland was like the other colonies, not quite as on fire for the Revolution, but they went along with it. And in fact, many of their people, many of their citizens served quite well in the Revolution. Many of them remained loyalists. But at the end of the day, Maryland went along with the other 12 colonies and voted for independence. By the time the convention had rolled around, however, Maryland had found itself in a somewhat almost Rhode Island-esque position. Rhode Island, of course, you will recall, was recalcitrant. Rhode Island did not send anyone to the convention. They wanted to maintain the Articles of Confederation because here they were the smallest state. And yet, because of the equal representation and because of their manipulation of certain votes in the Congress, they were essentially able to control everything simply by being the party of no, as it were. Maryland had somewhat of that reputation, although not quite as bad. Their close ties to Virginia, of course, because they were both tobacco states. Their friction with the Quakers in Pennsylvania. And they're quite good land in Maryland as well. But by the time the convention had rolled around, Maryland voted to send numerous delegates to the convention. But most of them felt like they had better things to do, including, by the way, staying in the Maryland legislature, because Maryland at the time was debating whether or not to issue a new kind of paper currency. And this was a hot-button issue in Maryland, and most of the people who'd been elected as delegates from Maryland to the Constitutional Convention felt that that was a much more important issue, and so they stayed home. At the end of the day, two guys went for Maryland, two of them. We've already met Daniel St. Thomas of Jennifer, and we've met Luther Martin. They went, but they completely disagreed with one another. One was very much in favor of federalism, the other very much against it. One in favor of a strong central government, Jennifer, one against it, Luther Martin. Consequently, because of the way the rules were set up for the convention, virtually every vote that went through the convention, with a couple of minor exceptions, but virtually every vote in the Maryland delegation was a tie, 1-1, which meant that Maryland's vote was essentially canceled out throughout most of the convention. They just didn't have it. They just didn't have any way to break that deadlock between the two of them. After the break, however, after the vacation, when it became clear that this was do or die time, the convention was really running out of time. The idea that they could spend years writing this constitution was not going to fly. It wasn't going to fly with the delegates, who were incurring expenses for themselves, which of course the states in some cases were going to pick up, but in other cases weren't, and states were notoriously miserly. But at the same time, these were men who were losing businesses, they were missing out on family events, they were not happy about being stuck in Philadelphia for unforeseeable months on end. They just didn't want to do that. And they knew they were running out of time. One guy, however, thought that they had oodles and oodles of time and that it would take oodles and oodles of time. And that was, of course, James Madison, who by this point in the convention is reduced to essentially being the secretary. I mean, he takes notes, as we know, and takes copious notes, as we know. But his ideas are regularly rejected, and his motions are regularly voted down. He has no real influence, per se, in the convention, really, other than the fact that he thinks that this is going to take all kinds of time. And this, of course, is not acceptable to the delegates. They're not going to do this. As they come back on August 6th, 1787, the heat has returned to Philadelphia. And it back into this stuffy room with no ventilation and no open windows. And because of the secrecy, you know, no doors are open, and the dress of the day, plus you've got Luther Martin in there. Boy, this is all they can take. And when Madison makes his suggestion that this is going to take months more, this is met with general disdain across the room. That's about the best way to put it. Including, by the way, these Marylanders, who now have suddenly seen their delegation grow quite significantly. They've added three new people. So now they have five delegates from Maryland. And if you're, you know, doing the math here, you know that five means that they can't really have a tie unless somebody doesn't show up. So from this point forward, Maryland's votes should be 3-2, or at least significantly that way, so that they can actually get somewhere. Maryland is hot to trot. They want to get this done. They want to get going. But they're concerned, too, because, of course, word has leaked out about the Rutledge draft. And now that the delegates return, not all of them on August 6th, by the way, barely eight states show up on the first day back from vacation. But now that they have the draft in their hands, Maryland is going to become the focal point of really the fights from here on out, in at least initially. Maryland is so distressed by what they see in the Rutledge draft that they call a special meeting for themselves, for their own delegates, to meet at 5 p.m. on August 6th. And they go and sit down at the boarding house where most of their delegates are staying. And they begin to argue amongst themselves. And believe me, it gets personal and it gets crude and it gets mean, with accusations flying at St. Thomas Jennifer, that if he had only supported Martin in his fight against this big government, they wouldn't have had to send these three extra people all the way to Philadelphia from Maryland. Look it up on a map sometime and figure out how to stop this. In fact, Maryland is still debating whether or not this is what we want, or do we just want the Articles of Confederation, quote unquote, amended in some way to make them more amenable to us. In fact, that's what we think we want. Indeed, they even discuss whether or not the people of Maryland would ever support such a constitution as has been drafted here. The argument is pretty intense, with most of the newcomers saying, absolutely not, there's no way the people would ever support this. Luther Martin, of course, feels the same way because he doesn't like it, but Daniel St. Thomas of Jennifer, which is still my favorite name of all the convention members, he believes that the people will support this and that this is necessary and that we have to go forward this way, because otherwise we're going to end up with more border wars with other nations now instead of just other colonies. If we don't get this fixed, we're going to have to go, you know, back this way. We know all of this because Madison didn't write any of this down, by the way. We know this because James McHenry, who is one of the three new delegates from Maryland, does. James McHenry is a name that will sound familiar to everyone because James is a fairly common name, and McHenry, as it turns out, is a fairly common name. But this James McHenry, who, although he's a doctor, and although he has served on Washington's staff during the Revolutionary War, although he will become a congressman and has been a congressman, although he will be very active in several presidential administrations after the Constitution is put into place, he's one of those people that we really just don't pay any attention to. As far as the convention goes, his primary contribution is that he writes down the Maryland discussion in their meeting and how fractured they are. And he writes about the fact in his journal that Maryland is very deeply concerned and very deeply argumentative about what's going on. That's pretty much his contribution to the convention. But it's enough that we know that at least one of the states is facing an internal crisis as they come back to this draft that Rutledge has put together. And remember, Rutledge basically through his sheer force of will has put this thing together. It's no longer 19 general principles of an outline of an idea that we think we might want to have. Now it's on paper. Again, it's not the paper that you'll end up with. In fact, the first article that we're going to debate is Article 4, Section 1, which doesn't end up as Article 4, Section 1, but it does end up in the final Constitution. That's the first thing we're going to debate as we set through this. You'd recognize the words as you see them, and you will in just a moment. But even through all of this, there are deep concerns, as expressed both by states and by delegates themselves, about whether or not this is the right way to do this. Are we going too far? Everybody has agreed that we're going too slow. We are going way too slow. And Madison's months simply aren't available to us. We have to get this done. And this is the first time that people really start putting a deadline on this. We have to be done by really the end of August, mid-September at the absolute latest. We have to be done with this, is the general consensus. And so it's recommended, one of the first motions that's made after the return is that we change the schedule. Hitherto, we've been meeting from 10 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. But now we're going to work longer and harder. Now we're going to work from 10 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. And as a part of this motion, it's included in the motion that there can be no change to that schedule. In other words, there's no further change. We agree that we're not going to change the schedule again. The motion passes almost unanimously. Everybody wants to get this done and get out of there one way, or they want to end it one way or the other. And they feel like if they put the nose to the grindstone, the elbows, grease them up a little bit, an extra hour a day doesn't seem like that much of a sacrifice. To us today, a 10 to 4 workday seems almost like a dream, doesn't it? I mean, who wouldn't want to work 10 to 4 as your full-time job? That'd be okay, right? I mean, you don't have to get up early in the morning. You get off early in the afternoon. You got time to go to the kids' soccer games and softball games and baseball, and you got time to, have a leisurely evening. But in 1787, it was a little bit different than that. And the one thing that this 4 p.m. start time does, remember, they didn't have electricity back then, and so they went to bed when the sun went down, which around this time of year in Philadelphia is somewhere in that 9 range, 8:30 to 9 o'clock range. But the evening starts getting, darker, and you've got to have all your evening ablutions and meals and all that finished long before then. 4 p.m. in 1787 is really right around formal dinner time. And the delegates quickly realized that working till 4 p.m. is going to put a crimp in their social plans. And there's some griping really quickly about this new schedule, this 10 to 4 thing. But it says they can't change it. So on we go to start debating what Rutledge has come up with. It's Constitution Thursday on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bowman Show.
Today's media. Print.
Print is dead.
TV.
TV's still sort of there.
Internet.
Internet is there.
All those sources come in our next podcast regarding today's media and how it's changed with social media.
And how it may change in the future.
So listen to us on Lawless Chat from the Podcast 99 Network.
They still haven't built a circuit that could hold him. The Eric Wallace Podcast.
This is The Scotsman.
And this is Drew.
And we are the Ale Evangelist Show, spreading the good news of good booze across the land.
Wine is nice, but beer is better.
It is indeed. So tune in to us on the Podcast 99 Network, where California comes to talk, www.podcast99.com. Doctor,
doctor. Hi there. I'm Christine Papworth.
And I'm Wendy Papworth Bates.
And we're your real estate doctors. Listen to House Calls with the Real Estate Doctors on therealestatedoctors.net and podcast99.com.
For the powdered wigs and knickers inside all of us, you're listening to Constitution Thursday.
I've mentioned this several times over the past week or so on my own regular podcast, the Dave Plausibly Live, that one of the things that we fail to grasp today is how deeply the framers and the founders of this nation believed in the ideals that they considered and contained in two documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. And I would, with that Constitution, I would put in there the Bill of Rights as well, the first 10 amendments. It's hard for us to imagine, because we have no real frame of reference, to go back to a time when the ideas that we take for granted, free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, trial by jury, unreasonable bail, writs of habeas corpus, all men are created equal. These kinds of things, electors, who can vote for Congress. We take these things for granted. In fact, the last time we actually even had a discussion about who can vote for Congress was an amendment, the 26th Amendment, back in the early 70s about giving the 18-year-olds the vote. And we've talked about this amendment on Constitution Thursday, and reality is that it was a gigantic social experiment more than anything else. And as it turns out, you know, as we've seen today, voter participation continues to go lower and lower and lower. And I think part of the reason for that is because, again, we don't comprehend how difficult these concepts were to the men who wrote them down. It's kind of intriguing to me in some ways, because there's a famous founder's saying, Monroe, if there is going to be trouble, let it be in my time, so that my children might have peace. The problem with that is that if the child never knows struggle, if the child doesn't, as the rabbis teach, come out of Egypt themselves, they don't really understand the difficulties that are being faced. And that's, I think, part of our problem. We don't comprehend these things because we've never experienced them. We have no frame of reference. We can talk about it. I can sit here and tell you how difficult it was. You can go read a book, but we've never experienced it. We just haven't. And until and unless sometimes we do, I don't know that we will ever appreciate the concepts that the framers, particularly, and the founders especially, were fighting so hard for. I've told you on numerous times about the difference between liberty and freedom, and how the founders of this nation were not fighting for freedom. They were fighting for liberty. They're two different things. They're two different concepts, although we use them wrongly, I think, interchangeably. Because we don't understand that, we take some things for granted. So as the convention came back on August 6th and met for a few minutes and handed out drafts and actually read the entire draft, can you imagine sitting through that, reading that in Philadelphia, in the heat of Philadelphia, sitting there listening to somebody read the entire draft of the Constitution in a very monotone voice? Over through the whole thing so that we can hear it into the record officially. By the way, you have a copy in front of you. I can, just as a personal aside, there's nothing I hate worse than somebody reading something to me that I have in front of me. I hate that. But that's what happened. The Marylanders, of course, are shocked by this. They want their meeting at 5 p.m., so they're going to go meet at 5, probably over a late supper, as it were. The rest of the convention's looking at this going, all right, there's things here we like. There's things here we don't like. There's things here that we still have to discuss. There are some things here that are going to require some massaging, as it were. Some of these things aren't going to make it. For example, Rutledge has put into the draft, as we talked about last week, the idea that the Senate is responsible for negotiating foreign treaties. That will be done away with, despite the fact that he put it in there because it would benefit primarily southern states and this and the prestige of the Senate, which of course now has equal voting. That's not going to make it. Really, that's the whole purpose of this, is to kind of streamline some of these things, and things like that aren't going to make it. But many of these concepts are. That still doesn't mean they have to be debated, not be debated. And that's where we, when we reconvene on the 7th of August, that's really where we start. In the original draft, Article 4, Section 1. Now, you know that today, this would not be in Article 4, it would be in Article 1. But originally it was in Article 4, Section 1, and it read, quote, "The qualifications of the electors for the House of Representatives shall be the same as those of electors in the several states of the most numerous branch of their own legislature." This today, again, seems fairly straightforward to us. We look at this today and go, well, okay, it seems wordy, but does it really matter to us? Because we know who can vote and who can't vote. In 1787, however, this was not quite so clear-cut. Prior to the Revolution, prior to the Revolutionary War, the electors of the local legislatures, remember that the colonies had them, the electors, however, were very limited. They had to be freemen. They had to own property. They could put conditions on them in other states, such as they had to belong to a certain religion or a certain church. All of these things could be put in place prior to the Revolution. However, after the Revolution, or during the Revolution, however you want to look at it, but since that time, several of the states had lowered their requirements for voting, including the property requirements, in some cases to zero. The delegates, some of them, saw that trend as a threat to the long-term survival of Republican government. What, you're saying? How could this be a threat to the survival of long-term Republican government? How could the idea that every citizen should be able to vote, and that was the idea, at the time it was just a question of who's, you know, actually a citizen, how could that be a threat to Republican government? Well, if you know anything about republics, you know that, generally speaking, they die out when, as has been observed by a Scottish economist, as soon as the people discover they can vote themselves the treasury, presents from the treasury, then the republic tends to fall into economic chaos and eventually it collapses into a tyranny and a dictatorship. This is a natural process. It's occurred to every republic that ever stood. And so the theory was, if you limit who can participate, if you limit who can vote, then you don't have this, for lack of better phrase, ology, this lack of this rabble voting on who's going to be participating, who's going to be controlling things. If people who have a financial interest in this are the people who are allowed to vote and allowed to express their opinions on it, then we're going to be better off that way. You wouldn't be surprised at the idea that some of the delegates supported this. Gouverneur Morris, of course, is one of the most vehement supporters of this, of doing away with this proposal that it be lowered to the equivalent of the states and the electors. He wanted some other provision substituted which would restrain the right of suffrage to what were called freeholders. Now, freeholders, again, were landowners who, well, they were landowners. That's what they were, freeholders. They were freemen who held land, and therefore they had the suffrage. They had the right to vote. And again, to us, it's a strange concept. And indeed, to many then, it was an appalling concept because the idea was, well, wait a sec. How do you limit this to just people that own land? Again, I don't know how many times we go back to this, but the Ben Franklin famous quip about the man that owned property. Now, Morris's idea was you had to own land. Well, in Maryland, pretty much everybody owned land because everybody that came to the colony of Maryland up to a certain point pre-revolutionary was given 50 acres for coming here. Hey, come on in, we'll give you 50 acres. So basically everybody in Maryland that hadn't sold their land was a landowner. But in other states, that was not the case. And so some states simply said property. You have to have X amount worth of property. Well, depending on what the level of that was, you could run into problems. And Franklin's famous comparison there, what happens when a man comes to an election and he owns a donkey? He owns enough property, the donkey's worth enough property that he can vote. But before the next election, the donkey dies, and he doesn't have enough money to buy a new one. Next election rolls around, he can't vote. Well, was the suffrage, was the right to vote, was it in the man or was it in the ass? Was his famous quip. And it drives home the point that today, to us, would make perfect sense. We would never accept the idea that you would deny someone the right to vote because they didn't own land or property. But in 1787, those looking forward to long-term republicanism, the idea that, you know, this representative idea of a government, felt that the idea that anybody voting was dangerous to the idea of the survival of a republic. Now, it's intriguing because even though the idea today to us is an anathema, at the same time, we watch as our nation's leaders seem over the last, let's say, 100 years to be desperate to open voting up to basically anybody and everybody. Now, the rationale behind this, of course, has become voter participation. We hear a lot of this now. In fact, a couple weeks ago, what was it? They recommended lowering the voting age to 16 because we got to get more people involved. But the facts don't stack up on that. The lower you make the voting age, it seems like, the less participation there is. Oh, you might get some initial surge to it, but overall, voter participation continues to go down. If Governor Morris were here today, he would tell you that's because they don't have any interest in doing so. They have a government in place that will essentially take care of them. They don't want to see any changes in that, so they have no vested interest in voting anyway. And that's why he would say, he would argue, I'm sure, that he recommended that we never give people who are not freeholders the suffrage, the right to vote in our system. There are counter arguments to this, of course. There must be, as you might conclude, because we're going to end up striking that. But keep in mind that the clause in question doesn't just give the right to everyone. No, it doesn't give the right to everyone to vote for their House of Representatives. What it does is it gives them within their state, however their state has defined, the lowest level of qualification is the qualification to vote for the House of Representatives. In some states, you can vote for your legislature, but not your state senate or your governor or whatever. So whatever the lowest level is of the state's legislature, then you can participate. This, as we're going to learn, has been well considered for several reasons, starting with the idea that, well, we believe that all men are created equal, and going forward from there. It's Constitution Thursday. It's Plausibly Live, the official podcast of The Dave Bowman Show. You'll find people who will argue this idea of suffrage. Who should be allowed to vote? Who should not be allowed to vote? Who should be permitted to participate in the process and who should not be? And there's some logic to the arguments, but what I want you to understand more than anything is that these arguments are nothing new. There are those who have argued that if you don't participate in the tax system, in other words, if you get money back, if you get more back than you've paid in, if you're a tax liability to the nation, you shouldn't be able to participate because essentially you're voting yourself largesse out of the national treasury. There are those who have advocated that if you haven't served the nation in the military, you shouldn't be allowed to vote. These are not unheard of ideas that you should have to earn this suffrage to participate. The problem, of course, is that, as I said, these ideas are nothing new under the sun. They're in many cases the same arguments that were made at the convention in 1787. As the scripture says, there's nothing new under the sun. And when you read some of these arguments, of course, Morris, when he makes his motion, doesn't really to exclude this lowest qualification element. Doesn't really explain why. Everybody sort of knows why. He believes that this is a danger to republicanism because everybody understands that people who are not invested in a system probably aren't going to use that system to its best advantage. Wilson, however, of James Wilson of Pennsylvania, he of the Three-Fifths Compromise, makes it clear, he was also on the committee, by the way, that Rutledge's committee, replies, this part of the report was well considered. We don't think it can be changed for the better because it's difficult to formulate any uniform rule of qualifications for all the states. I mean, if you think about this, how do you set a uniform rule for qualifications for electors for the House of Representatives for all 13 colonies that's fair and easily digested? He goes on to explain that if we tried to do that, if we came up with some innovative new idea, some new way of doing this, it's hard to come up with that because we don't want to go through unnecessary innovations. If we don't need to fix it, don't fix it. Why don't we just take what happens in the states and let them handle it that way? It would be very hard and disagreeable for the same persons at the same time to vote for representatives in the state legislature and be excluded from a vote for those in the national legislature. How could you do that? Morris, however, doesn't buy that argument. He says it's neither great nor novel that you have such a hardship that you can vote for one but not the other. The people are accustomed to it and not dissatisfied with it in some of the states. Some of the states' qualifications are different for the choice of governor and representatives in others, for different houses. Another objection against the clause as it stands is that it makes the qualification of the national legislature dependent on the will of the states, which he does not think is proper. Once again, we're back to this element of, well, what happens, and what's really hanging in the air here is very simple, and it ought to be obvious to everyone. What's really hanging in the air is Gouverneur Morris's deep concern that while for population and representative purposes, the slaves will only count as 3/5 of a slave, what he's really concerned about is, well, what happens if the state of Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, lower their qualifications for voting for their lowest house of representation in their state legislature? What if they start allowing slaves to vote? Now, all of a sudden, because of this rule, slaves would be permitted in those states, at least, to vote for the national legislature. Now, while that may not seem to skew things too much, at least on the surface, if you think about it, because, again, you're talking about an internal state, they're still only going to get the same number of representation. But what happens when we start expanding states? And what happens when it comes to choosing electors for other offices, i.e., president of the East here United States? Ellsworth thinks that this is okay. The right of suffrage is a tender point. It's strongly guarded by most of the state constitutions. The people will not readily subscribe to the national constitution if it should subject them to be disenfranchised. States are the best judge of this, he said, and the temperament of their own people. And this speaks to what Maryland is arguing about amongst themselves. Will the people accept this constitution? Well, if one of the first things the constitution does is disenfranchise the people from participating in it, it's surely not going to. There's an instructive lesson here. Ultimately, Morris is going to lose this argument, even though others, Colonel Mason, is going to argue, Mr. Butler is going to argue, there's no right of which the people are more jealous than that of suffrage. The idea that freeholders are the best defenders of this is well acknowledged. But there's a lesson here in the sense that, well, how do you define something? Freehold. How shall freehold be defined? Ought not every man who pays a tax vote for the representative who is to levy that tax and dispose of his money? Shall the wealthy merchants and manufacturers who will bear a full share of the public burdens not be allowed in the voice of them? Taxation and representation, Mr. Ellsworth reminds the convention, must go together. We keep coming back to the lessons of the revolution. And there's a bigger lesson here that I take from this. And again, it has been intriguing to me as we have gone through this study at how fractured and how divided our nation was in 1787. People say to me today, we've never been more divided. No, yeah, we have. Oh, we've been far more divided than we are today. To the point where we came within the breadth of a human hair of not having a nation. That's how divided we were. And at another point, we did divide, depending on which side of the legal question you're on. We find these men, and I'm intrigued by the idea that Gouverneur Morris argues so passionately for the idea of freeholding, having the suffrage. He is just dead set against the poor, as he calls them, having the suffrage, having the vote. You or I, in many cases, having the vote. He is convinced that this will lead to the destruction of Republican government. He is a big government guy. He wants a strong centralized government. He doesn't want the rabble voting. And he is against the three-fifths compromise. But before all this is said and done, and despite the passion with which he argues for all of these things, it's Gouverneur Morris who will put pen to paper and write those words, "We, the people of the United States." Despite all of this brouhaha, despite all of this controversy, despite all of this arguing, there's a realization among these men that time is running out and that they have to get this done, and that they have to get it done. If they don't get it done, disaster is going to strike. And what's been born in battle, the United States of America, is going to dissolve. It's a compromise with a purpose. It's not a compromise simply to get what I want and then move on. It's a compromise that understands, that looks forward, that says, okay, if we're ever going to achieve what we must achieve, we have to start somewhere. And despite the fact that I am unnerved by the idea of everyone having to vote, unnerved by the idea of the three-fifths compromise, I'm going to put my heart and soul into this and get it passed and get it in place, knowing full well that once it's in place, then we can start working from there. We've put in here that we can add, we're going to put in here eventually that we can amend this, that we can change it if we need to. And as Washington will say of it, it's not perfect, but it's the best we can do. But right now, this 10-4 thing is not working. We've only been doing it for 3 days, and we're already at each other's throats because we're missing dinner, and we're missing social hours, and we're missing social events. And this sucks. We don't, this 10-4 thing ain't working for us. Say many of the delegates. And indeed, despite the fact that it says we can't change this, 3 days later they say, you know what, 10-3 is just fine. We'll get it done. We're not missing dinner anymore, and we're not missing any more of the social events. So scratch that rule. 10-3 will do for me.
Constitution Thursday is a feature segment on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of The Dave Bowman Show, a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. Copyright MMXV. All rights reserved. For more information, log on to ConstitutionThursday.com.